CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney services as outstanding and excellent. Also, the Marcus Evans CFO Summit, which will be hosted May 18th through 20th, 2011. CFOs will attend strategic conference sessions, including special guest speaker Lorraine Chilvers, host of CFO Radio. This networking event presents a unique opportunity to develop meaningful and valuable business relations. For more information, please contact Christina Sears at 305-358-6138. Email her at mediapartners@marcusevansmi.com or visit cforadio.com for more information. And finally, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, published by CFO Magazine, the SEC has not kept Regulation 13D of the Securities Exchange Act up to date with today's times of accelerated trading platforms and faster news distribution, says CFO Magazine. Growth and the SEC has missed a prime opportunity to revamp shareholder reporting rules and level the playing field for hostile takeover activity, at least in the eyes of some influential market participants. As part of its desire to modernize the beneficial ownership reporting structure, the SEC has asked for comment letters on its proposal to update Section 13D of the Securities Exchange Act. Despite widespread concerns about the treatment of security-backed swaps and the 10-day disclosure rule, the SEC is broadly sticking with the status quo. In March and again on April 15th, prominent law firm Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen and Katz proposed in its comment letters to the SEC that the current 10-day reporting deadline be shortened and the definition of beneficial ownership be expanded. We believe that the current reporting regime fails to fulfill its stated purposes, Wachtell lawyers wrote in the letter filed with the SEC on April the 15th. The law firm believes that investors, issuers, and the market as a whole would benefit from such changes. Changing the 10-day disclosure rule is part of the larger project that the SEC is undertaking to modernize the rules. Dodd-Frank has a provision that gives the SEC the authority to close the reporting window, and it is on the slate. We propose that the period is changed to one day. A most recent comment letter reaffirms our call for a broader review of the shareholder disclosure system, says Eric Robinson, partner in the corporate practice at Wachtell. This argument is, in fact, not new. Many different groups have raised concerns over the 43-year-old reporting rules, including the SEC. Michelle Anderson, chief of the SEC's Office of Merger and Acquisitions, told MarketWatch that she has plans to recommend that the number of days activist investors have before they must publicly disclose their 5% stake in the company also be shortened. Existing timeframes for disclosure have been in place since 1968 as part of the Williams Act. Well, today, Mary Madden is joining us, and she is chairman and executive director of the National Association of Corporate Directors, the NACD, for the Atlanta chapter. Mary recently grew Information America, Inc. from zero to $25 million in profitable revenue with a venture capital backing and an IPO, and finally a sale of the entire company. The venture capitalist in that situation actually doubled their money, so great news there. She's experience with several other early stage companies as well as large and later stage companies who often acquire the entrepreneurial startup and companies. She's also worked to turn around companies that have misjudged the market, ignored financial warning signs, become too complacent to change, or found themselves unable to focus the company. She's been active for 8 years in the Central Eurasia Leadership Academy, providing education and contacts for rising leaders in the 9 countries of the Caucasus, Central Asia, and Afghanistan. Mary was recently president and COO for ValueBond, a fixed income online trading platform for brokers, dealers, and retail users. ValueBond has subsequently been sold to Knight Capital. Prior to this, Mary was president and COO of eAttorney, a legal recruiting and practice management ASP that has been sold subsequently to LexisNexis. And previous to that, she was CEO for Fabric.com, an internet retail seller of remaindered fabric. The company in that situation was sold to Amazon. Well, Mary started out her education. She has an MLS Library of Science degree from Columbia University and a bachelor's degree, math major and economics minor. And Mary has been awarded Inc. Entrepreneur of the Year, and she was a finalist for three consecutive years, and also was awarded Information Industry Association Entrepreneur of the Year. Wow, Mary, that's a lot actually to say. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Welcome. Thank you.
Well, Mary, let's start at the beginning. Let's talk a little bit about your first position and how that led you to where you are today. Tell us the journey that happened in between.
Well, my first position was when I graduated from library school. I went to work for New York Public, and I was working in the automation department. And I was lucky enough to be assigned the job of working on the dance collection, which is not its materials. It's not books. So it was a little bit unusual. I worked for several years in library automation, both in New York and then Boston. And then I went to Portland, Oregon, and worked for a book jobber that ultimately went bankrupt because they appreciated the book assets. In other words, the inventory they appreciated instead of depreciating it. So I learned something right there. But anyway, I was in charge of IT. And when they went through the bankruptcy, I left and came to Atlanta and started working with Buck Goldstein, and we started Information America. We took public records, which again were records with personal names and corporate names. Interestingly enough, the Library of Congress or the library records were much easier to deal with because they were in a standard format. The records from public counties or state governments, there was no standardization. So, but there was some similarity. I knew what a personal name was. Anyway, so we did that, and that was the company that we grew, took public, and sold. And then the theme through all these other companies has really been large databases, whether it was a database of fabric, a database of bonds, a database of applicants for jobs. And even now with the NACD, we have a database of members and prospects. So there's always been a database for me to work with.
Talk to us a little bit as we get into the show about the NACD. I'm a member, but tell a little bit about this, the National Association of Corporate Directors. What is it and who is it?
Well, it's 25 years old. It's located in Washington, but it also has about 22 chapters. There are 1,100 members, mostly public, but many, many private members. And it is not a lobbying organization. It's an education organization. So they've always tried through their chapters to educate directors across America. Now they're trying to educate people on the Hill because there are a lot of people who don't know what directors do, and a lot of them are in Washington. And that right now is a big problem.
So. Great. Well, we're very glad to have you be part of our show today. So let's talk. We've talked about directors. Explain, Mary, if you can, some of the mechanics of a board. What is it? How is it made up? Tell us a little bit about that as a backdrop.
Well, a board is a group of advisors, and the catchphrase is nose in, hands out. So you're not running the company, you're overseeing the company. You're there to ask questions, to give advice, but it's incumbent upon you to really learn about the business. And you can learn from reading all the documents. If it's public, the SEC documents. If it's private, they still have documents. You can go to conferences, analyst conferences. You can visit the company, which is really, I think, really important, visit the company, walk around. So you need to learn about the business, and then you also need to bring some skills on your own part. Boards usually say, I need somebody in marketing, someone in finance. They need a qualified financial executive. And so the board will meet as a whole, but it also meets in committees. There's an audit committee, a comp committee, and a nominating governance committee. And again, they meet periodically. They review. They ask questions. They ask tough questions, or they should be asking tough questions.
So who typically is going to serve in a board capacity? And just for purposes of our listeners that may not know, are you paid to be on the board?
Yes, you are paid to be on the board. And it's interesting that you bring that up because NACD just did a study about what the public's perception of boards is. And first of all, they don't understand what board directors do. But the public thinks directors do this for money. But in truth, they don't get paid very much. I have some statistics from a study. But even if I gave you the statistics, half the pay is in stock and has to stay in the company. And of the cash, oftentimes you have to buy more stock to get up to a certain percentage. So it may look like you're going to get a lot of money. You don't. But you might get a flight, a first-class flight on a plane. But most people do it because they want to meet other interesting people. They're interested in the business or businesses. Some people are interested in the power, the prestige that goes with that. They're usually, they traditionally have been Sydney executives. There's less of that now.
So a board member likely will have another job, or maybe somebody whose career is such that maybe they're in retirement or thinking about a partial retirement.
Yes. Again, traditionally, they've been sitting CEOs. Now it's more towards retirement or limiting your boards. I mean, it used to be you could be on five boards and be a sitting CEO. Now, many times the boards will restrict their CEO, so you can only maybe be on one outside board. Robert Posen, who's with an investment firm, has written a book on boards, and he thinks they should reduce the size to 8 people. They should all be retired, and it should be like a professional director. So it's, you know, they put like 300 hours into the company. They spend a lot of time on the company, more like the private equity model. Now, some people are adopting it, but not everybody.
And just out of curiosity, would that typically be a consistent flavor of private companies versus public companies? I tend to think of a board makeup being a team of advisors that supports the management of the company.
That's true. In public companies, though, many times they are investors. Certainly in private companies, if they've invested in the company, they're on the board. So the board of a private company may not have very many, quote, independent directors. They may be all either insiders in management or they may be investors. A public company will have, the majority should have outside directors because that's a listing requirement for New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. So they would not necessarily be significant shareholders.
Interesting. And that's great. That's a great background in terms of what we're talking about, board of directors. What are the complexities of working on a publicly traded board today? Is it different from it was 10, 20, 30 years ago? I know that certainly with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the financial reporting for a CFO has changed, and there have been some legal changes over the last 5, 10, 15 years.
There's a lot more scrutiny of boards, both by the SEC, but also by the press, by shareholders, by institutional investors. There's also been a change over the last 30 years between a majority of small shareholders to now. You may have a lot of small shareholders, but most of the shares are held by institutional investors.
And what do you mean by an institutional investor? Is that a pension corporation,
a
401k?
Yeah, it could be a pension.
Hedge fund.
Yeah, right. And the rule used to be, if you didn't like it, you sold your shares and left. But they have a lot of shares, so they want to exert their influence. So they do put pressure on the board. They do the proxy access questions and, you know, try and change the board if they get really upset. So right now there is more scrutiny. The Delaware law about business judgment, that is, if you follow a process and you act, your loyalty is to the company and not to yourself, then, and you can document the process, then you're not really liable. So the liability hasn't changed, but the scrutiny of your process has changed. And for a while, lawyers used to say, don't take detailed notes because then you'll get sued. Now they're saying, you know, document what you're doing because otherwise you'll get sued. The Disney case, it took years to solve that one because they didn't have notes. But ultimately, they were absolved. You know, they were not... acting in their own benefit or not paying attention. They just didn't write anything down.
And was that a suit that was brought against Disney?
Right after Eisner. No, it wasn't Eisner. Orbitz. I can't remember the guy's name. But when Eisner let the guy go that had been there for like a year and then paid him gazillions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. That was big news at the time.
Right. That's another thing that the public doesn't understand. Like, people were upset about Nardelli. But when Nardelli came to Home Depot, he negotiated an agreement on his pay. And if he got let go without cause, he would get a certain amount of money. It wasn't negotiated necessarily when he left. But people don't understand that. And mm-hmm. we all need to help educate people about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, so we've got a particularly complex element in terms of scrutiny. We've got some certainly some legal oversight in terms of makeup of the board mm-hmm. and what needs to be done. You mentioned that there were three committees, a nominating committee, an audit committee, and a compensation committee. Let's maybe firstly look at the audit committee, because I think that perhaps ties in most closely to the CFO. Talk to us, what is an audit committee? Who's on it? What is their purpose? What do they do?
Well, the audit committee, first of all, after Sarbanes-Oxley, has to have a financial expert, which often is a retired CPA. And the rest of the committee should be at least be financially literate. They go over all the paperwork that's presented by the auditors before it is released.
So financial statements, planning documents.
Right. And in fact, they engage the auditor. And they work with the auditor, and they, you know, so they go through the whole thing and really are checking on what the CFO is doing. And they need a really close relationship with the two of them, between the CFO and the board. So they work, and they used to be the spotlight. Right now the spotlight's moved a little bit, but and the CFO now has to certify the financial statements, as does the CEO. So the CFO has much more focus on them. But he has to, again, work with the audit committee and with the outside auditors. And that is now the auditors don't work for the CFO. They work for the committee. So it's a little, you know, it's a kind of mm-hmm. a little bit of a triage.
And that's when you're mentioning auditors, if an organization would ordinarily have a CPA external audit firm, but we're also talking about internal auditors to the
right,
company.
Right. The internal auditors are also very important these days. In fact, there was a testimony yesterday about whistleblowers, because the whistleblower law that came out of Dodd-Frank says that you can just go to the SEC and you get some tremendous reward. And so a lot of people are saying, do I work for the company or do I work for the SEC? And this includes internal audit people. So the testimony yesterday, the NACD was saying, A, you need to insist that the whistleblower goes through the company and not just go to the SEC, and you have to exclude certain people who have access to internal information, like internal audit and the CFO and the accounting staff, and some people who come in to work with it. So, yeah, a lot of that is changing, and the audit committee has to keep up with all these rules. In fact, the audit committee also has been asked to take on risk, because now everyone's worried about risk because of the financial meltdown. But risk isn't just financial risk. So the boards have been debating that, and a lot of audit committees have been pushing back, saying, you're giving us everything. Now let me give this back to you. So,
funny how that works.
Yeah.
That's my task. Go give that one to Johnny, right?
Yeah, right.
So that's the role of the audit committee. Well, as the, Mary, as the CFO balances his or her responsibilities, the financial aspects and financial and accounting aspects of the business, how does the CFO kind of place or rank in terms of the role of the audit committee? How does that balancing between the CFO and the audit committee work? Because the CFO is going to report directly to the CEO. So how do they align together?
Well, the CFO actually also reports to the audit committee in many cases, and they have to really work together. They have to talk, because the CFO is there every day. The audit committee, as knowledgeable they are about financial things, are not there every day.
And typically, so, how often would they meet? Would that be every month, every quarter?
It depends on the company and where the company is. Like if they're doing restatements, they're going to meet more often. If they're selling the company, they're going to meet more often. If they're acquiring things, they're going to meet more often. Our audit committee used to meet four times a year. But others meet, again, depending on what's going on, more frequently. Or a smaller cap company might meet more frequently because they might be running out of money and they need to look at the bank covenants and be kept abreast of all that. But they might do some of it on the telephone. So it has to be a trusting relationship between the two. And they have to work at it. You know, it isn't always easy because, again, it's kind of a matrix management.
Sure, sure. And in the capacity, the audit committee is responsible for making sure that in an advisory capacity that they are overseeing the financial statements that would be released out externally, whether that's in a private capacity to external people within the company, bankers, lawyers, and so forth, that might have a need to rely upon the financial statements. And clearly, in a public environment, it's the shareholder as well as additional investors through that capacity.
Right, right. It is very much so.
Well, in the company's world of financial reporting, obviously, financial statements are a big key of what is released to the public. Over time, various aspects of financial reporting may create the rise for concern to those that are serving on the boards. And the world in which we live, you mentioned the economic meltdown. My goodness, nobody could have seen that coming. So how does a director prepare him or herself for a board position? You have ever-increasing regulations, liability concerns for them personally, for which obviously you can minimize or mitigate some of that through insurance. But how does that director prepare themselves for the role that he or her is going to take on?
Well, you really alluded to a lot of it. It's education, but it's continuing education. There are various director colleges. We're having one at the Terry College, the University of Georgia, later this month. NACD has about three during the year, and they go over the duty of care, the duty of loyalty, the business judgment. They go over the role of the committees. They'll talk about pending legislation or what just happened in the last proxy season. So they'll bring you up to date. But then, for example, you might want to come to our NAC, I'm not supposed to be plugging, but you might want to come to our luncheons, because we try and bring people up to date on various topics. And then KPMG has an audit institute, and I think Deloitte has a program where, so it's continuing, it really is continuing education. But we need to remember that everybody shouldn't be a director. Either they don't have, you know, if you get a lot of CEOs are used to running things, and you get them on a board and they're not running the show. Again, the fingers are out, just the nose. So it's more of a collaborative environment, and everyone can't make that change. And everyone isn't willing to ask the tough questions. So it's a lot of things. You have to educate yourself. You also have to do a lot of research on the companies. And if someone talks to you about a particular company, you really need to do all the reading. You need to talk to everyone you can. You need to talk to other directors. You need to talk to C-level officers. You might want to talk to customers. You might want to go visit some of the facilities just to make sure. And of course, you want to talk to the auditor, and you probably want to talk to the outside counsel, because you want to make sure that there's a fit, that you can understand it, that there's nothing that makes you upset. So,
and the company would give you full and free access to this.
If they don't, then you probably don't want to be on the board.
Understand. Absolutely. Particularly in regards to the liability that you're taking on. In fact, talk to us a little bit about that. It is a highly regulated environment, and you mentioned the duty of care so forth. Is there any particular aspect of legal responsibility or liability of being a director?
Well, one of the things I didn't say that I should have is you need to read the DNO, the Directors and Officers Policy, and make sure that it covers. And you probably want to have your own advisor look at it, because one company, a director went off, and usually there's a tail, so you're covered for if some lawsuit comes up about work that happened up prior. Well, they changed their bylaws so that the prior directors weren't covered. And it went to the Delaware court, and the Delaware court said you can't really do that. But so, you know, you really need to be vigilant even when you go off the board.
So to that extent, as a director, you would maybe have your own attorney. And you probably are the kind of person that you're already used to looking at legal documents, but you're going to be pretty savvy in that regard.
Yes, but it's always good to have a second eye. I mean, you may be savvy, but you don't deal with DNO all the time. Or, you know, there are just a lot of specialized issues that you don't deal with, and you could be savvy, but, you know, you really need to get some extra advice. Anyway, there's a duty of loyalty, which prohibits directors from making a decision that benefits them at the expense of the company.
So loyalty to the company rather than your individual self.
Right. And with independence, that's gone a long way for that. But you can still be, for example, with this Buffett thing where David Sokol, he bought stock in this thing at the time he's recommending it to Buffett. They would say that's breaching the duty of loyalty. Mm-hmm. Another one is duty of care, which requires the directors inform themselves about all the issues that they have to deal with. And then in good faith, which means that you're actually making a decision in the best interest of the shareholders because you are representing the shareholders. So those three duties, and then the business process rule, which is the process and documenting the process and taking adequate time. I mean, some people have gotten into trouble because they look at an acquisition, millions of dollars, they spend an hour on it. Well, that doesn't quite cut it. So
what would you expect in terms of a time commitment? Obviously, there are companies that are going through massive issues, challenges, frauds, bankruptcies, and the like. Let's kind of put them aside. Let's talk about maybe a public board that is just well-oiled, the machine is running well, and there aren't any financial life challenges for the company. What would you expect as a board of director as your time commitment?
Well, if you're a director and not a committee chair, okay, the numbers I've seen are between, they're pretty broad, between 200 and 300 hours.
Per year.
Yeah. I think the 300 is more if you're a chair or there is some problem. But it does take a significant amount of time, and it's not all in meetings. It's, again, reading and keeping up to date on what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And meeting people within the company, analysts and that sort of thing.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right.
Does the board tend to do those activities of education and learning as a group, or would that be one-on-one?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of directors who've been serving for several years don't think they need to be educated. So the whole board can have in-boardroom education if they will all go along with it. Otherwise, they may send the one or two who want to go out someplace else to
maybe
have
to
education.
The plant facility or to see the smelting machine or whatever it is that the company does.
Right. Some boards meet in different locations so that the board has to visit these different facilities. And that's a good idea, especially if it's an international company, mm-hmm, because you're probably not going to get to the plant in China and then the plant in Israel and whatever. So.
Interesting. Well, that's a great backdrop. So now the director is prepared, he or she is on board, and we're looking at the relevance of what I would describe as regulation. We mentioned a little bit about the Dodd-Frank Act, but I'd like to step a little bit back to the CFO's comfort zone, which tends to be the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Talk to us a little bit about Sarbanes-Oxley. Has the work at this point in terms of the board become routine? Or is there still more that is being, if you will, fully determined and understood? Is the detail now just coming out?
Well, my personal indicator on Sarbanes-Oxley is the audit fees. And the audit fees have really leveled off. In fact, in some cases, gone down because they've gotten all the internal 404 work done. And they've gotten everything ready so everyone will sign off on it. And most of the work really was with the audit committee. So in most cases, I think it's fairly routine. There's a lot of grumbling about checking the box, you know, which is what Sarbanes-Oxley asked you to do. But I think it's gotten to be routine, and it's become a habit to check the box, so it's hard to get out of that habit to think about strategy.
I understand.
But that's not Sarbanes-Oxley. That's the board itself.
That's the board and the composition of overseeing the organization.
Right.
Interesting. Well, what keeps a board up at night? Is there a consistent theme among directors and in public companies? I mean, you've served on several boards. You've taken a couple of companies public. Talk to us a little bit maybe about your concerns in kind of time frames past.
Well, a lot of it is very situational, although I've said that, right now a lot of companies are worried about the changes in the tax, corporate tax. They're worried about what's coming out of Washington. But if you set that aside, which is a big deal, I think it depends on what the company's going through. I know some people who've in the past have gone through recalls, so then they're trying to figure out, you know, wake up at night, now how did we prevent this? What were we doing wrong? Or they just want to improve the board. You know, they've had done the director's evaluation and they've got Sarbanes-Oxley under their belt, but they want to be more strategic. They want to think out of the box. And so they're trying to figure out really how to do that.
Mm-hmm. And in that regard, board members, clearly as an element of education, a very strong element of education. explain to us, if you can, what is your typical prep for getting ready for a board meeting? Do you get information in advance? Does the board tend to review things for the first time in the boardroom? I mean, how does all of that work?
Well, the corporate counsel and the CFO send out a board book ahead of time. And it used to literally be a book. Now it's often a download on your iPad or the iPad they gave you. And it will cover everything that's going to be covered in the board meeting, and in fact, in more depth. And what is expected is that you will go through all that material very carefully and understand it. Maybe it's on the flight before you get there, but you should understand it. And then when you get to the meeting, it's best if they don't go through word for word everything in the board book, but take the high level points and talk about it, because there's often a problem with time. And if you have to go through every financial document or every legal document or every new customer, then you're not going to talk about strategic issues. You know, maybe the sales make you think about strategic issues, but you really should prepare in advance. And if you have questions, you know, there's no reason why you can't call the C-level executive that did that, or bring it up in your committee meeting. But there's a lot, you're expected to prepare for it. And then I, as a librarian, keep everything, but you're not supposed to keep everything. So you're not supposed to write on it, you're not supposed to keep it, and then they, with the iPad, they just kind of take it all away. It's really kind of cute.
I see. So the librarianship of that, the retention of that is out of your control nowadays.
Right.
Interesting. Right. Interesting. So that, I'm assuming from what you're saying, then you're not really supposed to keep that. There's a liability issue with regards to that.
Right. Yeah.
And making notes on it, or
right.
You know, your thought process, because let's face it, the intent of the board communication is to understand and give opportunity for airing of opinions, and your opinion could change.
Right. And you don't, you know, when I say you want to take notes about what happened, it's really the process that happened, not everybody's opinion on it. And what they worry about, although I've never seen it, is you get bored in a meeting and you write something that you really shouldn't be writing, and then it comes up later.
But. Sure, understand. Well, keeping on the track of legal and attorneys and such that we've been talking about, talk to us a little bit. We mentioned in the news broadcast about the Dodd-Frank Act. First of all, tell us what it is, and it's new. So tell us about where in the process and what the impact is.
Well, we don't have enough time for me to tell you, because it must be like 1,000 pages. But parts of it have been implemented, like say on pay. And say on pay was kind of broad enough that the company or one of the proxy access people could make a recommendation about how frequently you do it. The company and the proxy would say, well, we would like to do this every 3 years. So that would be one issue. And then you'd put the pay on there, and they would approve the pay because they had to do it the first time. Well, ISS wants you to do it every year. The companies often want it to be 3 years. I think most of the votes that come out every year. It's an advisory vote, but it is every year. So that one is working its way through this year's proxy season. The proxy access, which has a lot of people up in arms, has been halted by some litigation. But from what I understand about the proxy access, you have to have 3% ownership. You have to have it for 3 years. And if you're putting in a slate of directors, you can only put in 25% of the directors. And if one of your directors gets elected and then serves well, so they renominate him, he's still part of that 25%. So there are a lot of barriers there, especially if you're a big company. But that's been put on hold. And then we were talking about before the whistleblower. They had hearings about it yesterday, and there's a lot of concern about the whistleblower. So that's on hold.
And that's also part of the Dodd-Frank Act.
Yes, it is. These are all part of the Dodd-Frank Act. So part of it, just as you had said about the recommendations you were making, they're trying to make recommend changes on the whistleblower to exclude certain people, to lengthen the time that the company has to react. So part of it's been implemented. Part of it is being fought. And that's really where it stands.
Typically, what is the process in terms of a law comes out and we have the Dodd-Frank Act, and then first and foremost, the general public or those that are interested parties read and review and try and understand and disseminate. You said there's 1,000 pages and that you're talking about whatever it is, several hundred, several thousand. It's a complex document. And one paragraph could turn the meaning of many pages within that document. So would a board bring on the legal counsel of the company to evaluate that on behalf of the board?
Well, or the board might bring on legal counsel, because the board could bring on their own legal counsel. But yes, and from my understanding, and again, I haven't read the whole thing because a lot of it was written so that when it passed into law, the regulators, like the SEC, could decide how to implement it. So then the SEC would issue a statement on this is how we're going to implement it and open it for comments. And then people would submit comment letters like you read about, and NACD submits comment letters. I think I even submitted a comment letter on something. So, and then there's like a review period, and then they come out with what they plan to do. And then if someone really doesn't like it, like the proxy access, then they sue to stop it.
And has that taken place?
They have sued to stop it, but it's pending the judgment
the
now.
The process and the judgment.
Right.
So watch this space. And check with your attorney.
We have to keep it interesting.
Well, in that regard, in the role of the board of director position that you serve, are you concerned by these kind of new legal acts, or is it just, again, more part of the education for you?
Well, it's more the education. It would be nice if there weren't so many regulations, or if the regulations would actually stop some things like this, like we had with the financial meltdown. In fact, there was a great book about paying for nothing by, I think, Gillespie, and it's about boards that were inappropriate. Like, a lot of boards wanted to have a star on them. So, like,
somebody famous, somebody like a Hollywood person or something
like
that.
Well, like, O.J. Simpson was on the Swiss Army Knife Company board. You know, I mean, and then Lehman had a female general. Well, I don't know what she knew about financial. I mean, it just, they wanted these certain kinds of stars.
Kind of a prominence.
Yeah.
Figurehead.
And that's probably not the best way to go about it. So, you know, I think some of the boards really have to be asking more questions. I don't know that it's all bad. Mm-hmm. It's a little over the top, but it's not all bad.
So you're really focusing on succession planning and making sure that the board has the correct makeup. And that's a duty of care aspect.
Right. People should be focusing on the succession planning. But people are reluctant to ask someone to leave or saying you're not doing your job. But there's more talk about succession planning these days. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Mary, I know that I could talk for hours on this topic. I serve on a couple of boards myself that are maybe not publicly held, but certainly the Dodd-Frank Act is actually meandering into the private and the nonprofit world very, very fast. But we're coming towards an end of the show, and we have a tradition on the show to ask your CFO tip of the month. From the perspective of the board, what is yours?
Well, I guess I might have a couple, but I think the CFO should meet with individual board members and just get to know them, and not just the audit committee, because they're going to rotate. And I think if they don't understand the financials, they're more likely to ask you a question one-on-one than they are otherwise. It's also an opportunity if you're taking a director around, and let me use an example of Home Depot. Home Depot spent a lot of money buying handheld machines a couple years ago. So if the CFO was walking around, because we know they walk around, and showed the board members or a board member how that capital acquisition is being used in the firm, it would make it more real for the director, and it would help them understand what's going on in the company. So, you know, I think increasing interaction and not all just on the financials.
So look at the operations, go visit the plant, go visit the manufacturing environment, or if you're a services organization, go meet the people.
Right. And you know, it's an opportunity to figure out if they really understand the financials, you know, to give mm-hmm. them, you know, well, I can go over this, you know, sort of mm-hmm. thing.
Well, that's a great tip. I think that'll serve our listeners very well. And I'd like to thank you, Mary Madden, for being our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO and the board, the audit committee. Thanks also to our contributor, CFO Magazine. And thanks go to our three sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike, For more information about Delaney, go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks go to the Marcus Evans CFO Summit, which will be hosted May 18th through 20th. CFOs will attend strategic conference sessions, including special guest speaker Lorraine Chilvers, host of CFO Radio. This networking event presents a unique opportunity to develop meaningful and valuable business relations. For more information, please contact Christina Sears at 305-358-6138. Email her at mediapartners@marcusevansmi.com or visit CFO Radio for more information on the summit. And finally, thanks go to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website is financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, we are doing a casting call currently for the next 3, 6, 9 months. Please contact us via the web. Thanks to listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.